Welcome to the Living Dice Podcast. Today's show, The Gamer Social Contract. Welcome. Hey, I'm your host, Trent. Here's my cohort, Stuart. Say hello, Stuart.
Hello.
All right, before we get going, we really need to define terms. So what is the gamer social contract?
Well, it's what you should do as both a game master and a player, how you should bring your expectations to the game, what you should be okay with and what you should not be okay with. Just like any social contract, it's the unspoken ties that bring us all together.
Oh, you make it sound so official and so socially conscious. I don't disagree with you, but my take on it is a bit more basic. It's sort of a fundamental. If you're agreeing to play the game, there are certain criteria you should meet, both as a player and as a game master. And as long as you meet those criteria, everybody has a good time. If you don't, things go horribly wrong and you wind up as a cautionary tale on Reddit.
Speaking of, that was kind of the genesis for this conversation. I was reading an article on Reddit, and the person posed the question, when is it okay for a game master to TPK, or total party kill, your players? And I was reading through the discussion, and it just made me want to grab my soapbox. So I apologize because I'm now standing on my soapbox.
But okay. Is it like a Tied soapbox or is it a full crate?
I'm a pretty big guy, so it's going to have to be a crate.
Uh-oh. Okay, go ahead.
But the answer is, with an asterisk, which we'll talk about in a second, never. It's never okay as a game master to TPK your party. That is not in the social construct of why we're playing a game. A game master's one and only job is to facilitate players having fun. So that's, you know, we said there's an asterisk. There are some crazy groups where they want to play the game in that style where a TPK might be acceptable. But for general terms, it's not. It's like a movie. You don't have all the good guys die, generally, unless you're a George R. R. Martin movie. But you don't do that. That's not your job as a game master. It is your job to be world builder. It is your job to create the monsters or bring the creatures forward, all the bad guys. It's your job to put challenges ahead of the players, but not at the sake of the entertainment. You first and foremost are entertainment. You're a director. You're making a movie through game. You have to have fun first and foremost. You should not, and here's where I really will get higher on the soapbox, it's not your job to facilitate what the rule book says, no matter what. It's not your job to follow the written word on a pre-printed adventure, no matter what. It's your job to make sure your players have fun. Now, you can do all that. You could follow it and you can do it. And GMs who are good at, you know, coming up with stuff on the fly will have a much better situation than GMs who don't, or especially new GMs who are coming into this. But you have to always have fun first and foremost before the rules.
I don't disagree with you. However, let me clarify that. I do disagree with you somewhat because I am a Darwinist when it comes to gamers. There are moments when despite your best efforts to facilitate a theater of the mind and have a lovely interactive story that's entertaining and everybody has a great time, sometimes your characters just what's the word I'm looking for?
Do stupid things?
Yeah. There's only so much plot armor you can pile on when they're standing in a warehouse full of gasoline and they light a flare. or you know, there's a bomb about to go off, and one guy seems to think that he can just you know, absorb the blast. Or my personal favorite, you can hand one rope to a cleric, grab the other end to some giant barbarian, jump into a raging river, and expect to walk across the river without having to make any checks. There are moments like that that just demand extinction of the party.
All right. Well,
if nothing else, just as an object lesson.
Let me bring the counterpoint here. You know, you mentioned when the first thing you said is theater of the mind. You know, yes, I prefer theater of the mind style gaming, and I believe you do too, but that's not for everyone. So we're not saying you have to do certain ways of playing the game. Whatever's fun for your players is okay. If that's, you know, tactical wargaming on a map with lots of rules and lots of dice, fine. If that's diceless game, fine. Whatever is fun for your players, it's the players and the GM. That's the social contract. You're coming together to have fun. So you have to make sure whatever you're playing is something that you're going to have fun at. There has to be some sort of agreement with the style of gameplay. But that said, people will always make daring moves that may not turn out very well in their favor, and that's okay. And I'm not even saying you can't kill people. I'm not saying that you don't want to take away the sense of danger if that's fun for the group. If you have someone, the kind of people who invest in their character and their character's everything, and if their character died, they would not be having fun. It's your job as a GM to not kill that character. I know it sounds silly, but that's the whole point in putting fun at the top of the list before rules, before repercussions, before damage and dice and everything else.
So, okay, all that said, let's get back to our core point here, which is about the gamer social contract. So for the GM, your argument is the GM's sole responsibility is everybody has to have fun. It's
not sole, but top.
Top responsibility. All right. We can both agree on that. So let's move on to something else. I mean, what else does the GM have to bring to the table to make it a good game? Now, if you don't mind, I will start with this. It's my pet peeve, and it drives me bonkers. You got to show up with a plan. The plan will not survive contact with your players, and you will have to improvise. You have to be extemporaneous in your speech. But man, you need a plan at the outset of some sort. It could be a handful of notes. I, for one, am a pretty low prep GM, so I have notes because I know I can pick it up on the fly. But if you can't, you should bring 25 single-spaced pages of text with you in case the players do something nuts.
I agree. I think that as a game master, you have to bring a plot. You have to bring a set of objectives, and you have to bring yourself, really. I mean, you don't want to be a game master and, you know, have a game once every 6 months because you're always busy. Because you're creating this environment for your players to, again, have fun at. So you have to do this, and you're correct. You need to have a plan. Now, there is the stuff that you need, and then there's the stuff that is nice. Bringing nice illustrated maps, which I love, that's extra. Talking your NPCs talking in funny in-character voices, that's extra. You can do all of these things that are extra to support your game, but don't let that scare you. You don't have to do that to be a good GM. But we're kind of going off topic. Probably what it makes to be a good GM, what we're talking about now is what the GM must do as a social contract with the players. And you are agreeing, number two, after having fun, is you need to have a plan.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that everybody has to have the same plan, or it has to be spreadsheets, or, you know, George R. Martin grade plot post-it notes scattered all over a wall, though I've seen people do that too. It's just have some high-level idea of how the game will progress, and then commit to making sure that the game happens, that you not necessarily drive the players to your plot. That's a wrong approach. Again, bit off topic. That's good GMing. But you've got to provide some kind of framework for them to operate in. And honestly, about 90% of the time, they'll do something unexpected and your plan goes out the window anyway, but at least they have a framework to start from and it makes your life a lot easier. But it's just that expectation that when you show up, you've got, you know, the red wedding in your back pocket, or, you know, you're going to blow up Alderaan or something to drive the story forward.
Yeah. And I think, you know, to twist that another way, you said that your how a GM plans doesn't have to be the same. And I would counter that with it's rarely ever going to be the same. I mean, every GM needs to know themselves as a GM, because what you bring to the table is going to depend on you, how you GM, what you're good at, what you're not. Do you need to have a red wedding in your back pocket, or are you the kind of GM that can just come up with that on the fly based on the situation? And if the answer is no, you can't, you're not good at coming up with it on the fly, then yeah, you should have something pre-generated to kind of help you along. That's going to be up to each individual GM, but that all again ties into my point, which I'll make ad nauseum, is because you're wanting to present the players with an experience that's fun and exciting.
That's true. But preparation, while it's kind of a catch-all, there's one element of this contract that I think people often overlook, and you alluded to it earlier when you talked about the rules, is that you have to be flexible. As a bullet point on what we're talking about today, it's flexibility, whether it be plot, character development. I've seen a lot of GMs, and I've been a victim of many GMs who are more interested in advancing their plot versus the plot the players are actually interested in.
Yes.
And that disconnect can be tremendously painful.
Yes.
Like, yes, you need to go attack the giant on the mountain, or not. We could go steal something to go help us with this quest. Anyway, the bottom line is if there's a mismatch, it's like two ships passing in the night and the GM doesn't have any fun because his plot's disappeared and the players feel like they're fighting uphill like Sisyphus.
Yeah. And that's another point. I mean, the GM has to adapt. Again, it has to adapt to the players really in their play style, because, you know, for example, the game that we play in, the players as a whole will follow up on some things, but they don't really go for the little rabbit hole. So we don't need to come up with plots that are, you know, George R.R. Martin-esque, where they weave this tale of a discovery. But then there's another game that I play in, and it's very much like a beer and pretzels game. And if I have a plot more than the very highest level of we need to kill the giant on the hill, by the time the next game comes around, they're not going to remember anything. So it's just would be a waste of my time to present that. So again, you know, you gotta figure out what it is that your players want to do and bring that. But if your players want a game that revolves around their characters and you bring a game that revolves around the NPCs, they're not going to have as much fun as they could.
Well, they probably won't have any fun. I've had that experience a couple of times. But all this to say, when you're GMing, and you and I both GM pretty extensively and have for, I've been doing it since I was 13. So that makes this, it dates me 33 years. I made some mistakes early on that I have learned from. I think I've gotten better from that, but those are the key elements for me. But there's one thing I want to throw out there, because I know it's a lowest priority, but it should be at least mentioned, is be familiar with the system so that you know enough to break it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because if you, let's take 3.5, not to beat on 3.5, but I consider 3.5 one of the middle of the road to the high-end complexity, high-crunch games. There's much worse out there. I'm not saying there isn't. But with 3.5, as a GM, so much was quantified. Occasionally, you just had to chuck the system to make the game work. The classic example being the grapple rules, which were nonsensical. Those definitely needed to be abused by your GM in order to make the system work a little better. But if you didn't know that and your players were expecting some high precision game, it just allows you more flexibility to be able to bend the rules because you know the system.
Yeah, Yeah. And it depends on the system too. I mean, 3.5 is very much a tactical miniatures kind of game, and all those rules are built in. So something like that, like the grapple rules, are probably less about a GM kind of breaking the rules on the fly more than maybe needing to patch or make house rules to the game to make it more fun for their players, depending on how the players wanted to play.
Which goes back to my original point, because you can't break the rules until you know them.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
If you actually follow the rules as written in 3.5 for grapple, you're in for a headache. It's even worse. It's like turning or counter turning or bolstering. There's a laundry list of things that just seemed like more hassle than they were worth. So yeah. As a GM, you sort of jettison those.
Well, but in some games are like that. And if you remember when we played Aces and Eights, I mean, there's tons of rules for, and everything like cattle drives and, you know, all of these things had their own separate set of rules that were pages long. And it was a bit much, but it was a bit much because that game didn't match our play style. I'm sure there's people out there that is their play style and they love it. But you're correct. You need to know the rules to break the rules. And I'll give you an example. And I know that we play together, so hopefully this doesn't diminish my story. And if any of my players are listening, you can pause it for a few minutes. But when I'm running like combat, say combats where you have a creature and you have hit points, if I'm running the combat and the creature goes down in a very non-dramatic, way too quick method, I just keep going with it. I ignore what the book says the hit points are supposed to be, and I let the creature live until we have a fun time with it, until it has some sort of dramatic conclusion. A lot of GMs, and me myself in the early days, wouldn't do that. It's more of a present a challenge. The players overcome that challenge. But I don't think in my experience that was the correct way to do it. The challenge is for the players to have fun, not to beat a number written in a book.
I don't disagree. I think it's a good plan, just because there's nothing worse than a villain who stands up and says, "I am the almighty dark overlord," and the players swat him down like some insignificant mook henchman. Then yeah, absolutely. He needs to get some extra buffs or whatever it takes to make him worthy of his title of dark overlord.
Yep. But again, counter to what I'm saying, if your group is the kind of group that likes the math, if you like setting your characters up and having these challenges, then it might be in the GM's best interest to not change those rules if that's what's going to be fun for your players. If they want to see how fast they can kill the bad guy, then you could be doing more harm than good.
I agree. But I think we need to look at the other side of this coin now. We've beat on the GMs a bit. So I think it's time we brought in the rest of the group.
Oh, yeah.
So the players. The players are special to me. They, as a GM, they hold a special place in my heart. And if they fail to amuse me, I shall punish them. But during all this, when they endure my stories that I tell, my plots I create for them, they have to come to the table with some stuff too. And if they don't, it makes a bad experience for everybody, not only myself, but the other players. So I'll let you go first, because I'm sure you've got plenty on this one.
Yeah, I mean, so the social contract of the player is, you know, much like the GM, just realize that we're there to have fun, you know, and that goes many different things. You know, we make sure you have respect at the game table. Don't get into arguments. Don't cause unnecessary disruptions. You know, pay attention to the game. Your game master is giving you a story. They're taking time out of their life to give you entertainment, to facilitate your entertainment. And you need to give that respect back to the game master. Keep focused. You know, try to play the game to the best that you can. And if you're not liking the game, that probably comes back to what we've talked about already, is you need to make sure that everyone's playing the game that everyone likes to play.
I think part of that too is that you should at least speak up and make your voice heard, because sitting there and stewing in your own juices and your impotent rage that the game is not the style you expected serves no useful purpose. I mean, at least if you talk to the GM as an aside, and then perhaps you can, he'll either change his play style or he gives you the kind of history of the group or whatever the issue may be. It's just going to make for a better game, which of course goes back to the fun, which is the ultimate goal of the whole exercise. I mean, you took 4 or 5 hours out of your life to have a good time,
yeah,
not to be stressed out and miserable.
Yep. And really that comes down to communication, you know, whether you want to call it feedback, whether you want to call it evaluations, it's all of the players in the GM need to have open communication outside of the game about the game. The game master needs to know that you're having a good time because it's their goal that you have a good time. You need to make sure that is connected. If you like something, let them know so they know, hey, this was something good. If you didn't like something, let them know so they can know that's something you didn't like. I mean, that kind of feedback is vital for the game to be continued and successful.
Yeah, I agree. And that being said, I know that gaming is moving towards a more inclusive model that everyone's welcome at the table. But there is one group that I discriminate against freely, and I'll put that on the door to my house, is don't be a jerk.
Yeah.
that's not too much to ask, although that applies to GMs as well. For the most part, I see it that tends to be more a player issue, although you might disagree with me on that. Don't be a jerk.
I've definitely had jerk GMs as well, but yeah, I mean, everything we're talking about today is having fun. And if you're a jerk, you're not having fun and you're potentially ruining other players' funds. Not good. Not good.
Yeah, I mean, there's just no two ways about it. But even then, there's some mechanical things like, you know, show up prepared, show up at least knowing the system. Although I will give a mulligan on this one for new players, because we can never have enough new players in the hobby. So if somebody shows up who's never played before and they're ignorant for the first month, no problem. We'll get them up to speed. But if you've been playing for 6 months and still don't know how to roll an attack roll, you might want to crack that book open.
Yeah, yeah. And get a book. I mean, this hobby doesn't run on itself. So, you know, companies make these games. We like to play them. It's very reasonable, I would say. Even if you bought like a $50 book, I know it sounds expensive, but if you're playing this, you know, 100 hours, I mean, that's peanuts. That's peanuts. So you also have to support the hobby. But, you know, again, it all comes down to having fun. I would not want to disclude someone in a financial situation that it couldn't afford a book. But if you are in that situation, take some notes, you know, get some printouts or copies of cheat sheets or something, so you can grasp the game enough to not slow down the game at the table.
I agree. And it's simply a matter of, you know, other things like that. It's almost like things your mother taught you on the first day of school, like show up on time, listen, be polite. I mean, I hate to say that stuff, but you and I have both been at tables when it's an issue.
Yeah, yeah. And if you're going to a convention, take a bath, please.
Ooh, yeah. Personal hygiene.
But, you know, there's one other important piece, though. Players need to recognize that the GM has a lot on their plate. And I'm not just talking about, like, life in general outside of the game. But even in the game, you know, they're presenting this world. They have these adventures built up. You need to allow the game to progress without being a thorn. And I'll give you two examples of what I mean. So attendance is one thing. If your character has to miss a session, that's fine. Life happens. But when you come back to the game, come back to the table, don't expect to take time for the GM to figure out where your character was during all of what happened in the last session and find a way to integrate in and all of this stuff. You just were there, or you weren't there. You just move on, basically. We don't have time to do that because it doesn't really matter at the end. Now, the second thing, probably the most important thing, it could come down to any session, but it really comes down to kicking off kind of story arcs. Mostly people don't like railroading adventures. And I guess maybe if people don't know what Railroading Adventures is, it's where the GM kind of has hand-holded you to a certain place. You were destined to do this. Just know, well, first, let me start with, when you start off a campaign, you've got to suspend disbelief of all this and where you're starting. The GM has created this world, spent time creating this world. You need to start on the path that they have chosen. Is it railroading? Yes, but that is part of the game. You can't just start off anywhere you want unless you have a GM that just completely builds everything 100% on the fly. You have to allow that mindset of just going along with it. Now, I'll tell anyone who is not a GM, all GMing is basically railroading. If you're a prepared GM, if you're a prepared GM, you have, okay, players are going to do this. They're going to do this. They're going to do this. They're going to do this. The good GMs allow enough wiggle room in there that the players don't feel like they're being railroaded. They kind of come to those conclusions themselves, whether it's through information or whether you have to adapt your big fight. Maybe it's not on the top of Mount Doom. You just have this big fight and it can be wherever it is that the players choose to go. So it's a mixture of that. So once you're in the game, yes, you should not have the feeling of railroading because generally that's not fun, but you have to allow some suspension of disbelief for the GM because they're preparing this stuff for you.
Yeah. And it's more for this element of it. I think the players need to be committed, which sounds odd because it's basically poker night using Dungeons and Dragons or any other game of your choice, but they have to commit to the game in terms of preparation, in terms of when we're playing, like we have a really good group we play with. Shout out to our current Numenera table. They are, you can literally see the gears turning in their head when they get into something, whether it's a social situation or they're trying to beat down the bad guy, whatever it is. You can literally see the gears spinning and the steam coming out of their ears as they calculate their next move and prepare to implement something that will, you know, advance the story or complete some character arc or something. But they are present. I guess that's the word I'm looking for. They're present.
Yes, I agree. I think you have to be present. I don't think it's universal truth that you have to be the kind of player that, you know, you're remembering all these plot lines and having those gear turnings because, you know, there are some groups that they just want to get together and throw dice and, you know, kick in the dungeon door, fight the ogre, save the princess, repeat every week is fun for them. And that's okay because that's what's fun for them. But when you're doing that, you have to be present. You're absolutely right.
So I don't want to flog this to death because the social contract essentially is basic courtesy when it boils down to it. But because I would argue that the role-playing games are the one hobby that are intrinsically cooperative, but there is a leader. The GM is clearly a guide, for lack of a better term, for this story, and the players are participating, but they have input as well. And it's hard, and I'm hard pressed to come up with any other hobbies or fun activities, you know, outside of work that sort of fit this model. And I think it might be a little confusing, especially for a newer player who doesn't quite get what it is.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of new players to the hobby, I mean, they have some experience with role-playing games, or I'm sorry, with board games, but board games are different because they have, but like a role-playing game, they have an established rule book, but there is no game master generally for a board game, and for the fairness to all players, everyone must follow the rules or an adaptation of the rules that everyone has agreed upon. Other people come in from the video game world where they may have played role-playing games and such in video game format. Again, that's different because your game master is a computer. Your world is predefined. You cannot break the rules in any way. You're just kind of playing through them. So a tabletop role-playing game is really a different experience from both of those normal gateway games.
Exactly. Regardless, I think we've had enough on this topic. I don't want to belabor the obvious, but I think there's a lot there. And as if we provided some thought for people who are listening out there, then I hope we provided some value today. If you're interested in following up on this, I'll do a short write-up on this, and it will be at livingdice.com/5. Or excuse me. Show number 4. Number 4/4 on the livingdice.com site, and that'll take you right to the show notes. Stu, do you have anything else?
Happy rolling.
Happy rolling. All right. With that, we sign off, and we'll see you next time. Bye.